Today is July the 29th, 2020. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know what time it is? It's time for the award-winning Personal Computer Show. Back on August the 4th, 1983, the Personal Computer Show had its debut. This week we conclude our 37th year, and next week, August the 5th, 2020, we start with our 38th year. We thank all the listeners for your continued support. I've been asked if we can resume with listener calling in. I have been exploring how it can be done when the pandemic restrictions are lifted. I'm interested in your feedback as to the format. Taking live calls is possible, but not necessarily safe when people are driving, because we are on drive time on the East Coast. I can take questions and call back at your convenient time to record the conversation for broadcast. You can leave me with your thoughts on this. The email address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet, as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. Headline news. Intel announced it will require outside fabricators and how to receive free local broadcast service. And one of the oldest businesses on the Internet just got sold for $9 billion. Our feature segments this evening is with the IT Pro Series, Benjamin Rockwell, preparing and planning for what happens if I got hit by a bus. And from the Tech Corner, I'll be covering bad power attack corrupts fast chargers. They can melt or set your device on fire. How to fix Windows 10's latest no internet connection bug. How do you connect all those devices together? And bloatware. What it is and how to get rid of it. One of my favorite subjects. Or hands on tech with Marty Winston when the thermostat is where it's at. Everyone knows what a thermostat does. Many people know what a smart thermostat does. Marty Winston will look at what it does and wonder what else it ought to be doing. Intel said the release of its next-generation chips would be delayed by 6 months. They are seeing an approximate 6-month shift in their 7-nanometer-based CPU product timing relative to prior expectations. The primary driver is the yield of the 7-nanometer process, which, based on recent data, is now trending approximately 12 months behind their internal target. They have identified a defect mode in their 7-nanometer process that resulted in yield degradation. They root caused the issue and believe there are no fundamental roadblocks, but they have also invested in contingency plans to hedge against further schedule uncertainty. Intel had previously said that the 7-nanometer chips would launch in 2021. In addition to the delay in releasing the 7-nanometer chips, Intel offered a weaker-than-expected guidance for its third-quarter earnings results. Intel has been falling behind Moore's Law, which states that the density of transistors in integrated circuits doubles roughly every 2 years, and in layman's terms, this has come to mean that digital chips become twice as efficient and halve in cost every 24 months. Intel co-founder Gordon Moore formulated this theory over a century ago, but his legacy enterprise has fallen behind the curve. By the way, the Law's Moore is not a physical law based on physics. It's a marketing, and it caught on and people have been using it. Intel announced it would be pushing its 7-nanometer chip release out to 2022 or 2023. By this time, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company will have already begun its production of 3-nanometer transistors. Financial analysts are saying Intel is losing its innovative edge and its controlling CPU market share is soon to follow. Intel announced that it will require outside fabricators in a contingency plan to keep up with the digital demand, and the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation is the obvious choice for external manufacturing because of its scale and expertise. Bloomberg News, however, their headline news was, Intel weighs exit for manufacturing chips. That's not the case. Intel said the following, to the extent that we need to use somebody else's process technology, when we call those contingency plans, we will be prepared to do that. That gives us much more optionality and flexibility. So in the event there is a process slip, we can try something rather than make it all ourselves, which means not give away the whole thing if they had to. The Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company has succeeded by just focusing on production and leaving the design to other companies. Its factories have passed Intel in capabilities in manufacturing capacity, and that has helped Intel rivals such as Advanced Micro Devices, Inc. to catch up on performance. Intel's current best technology, known as 10 nanometer in the industry, was scheduled to appear in 2017 and is only now making it into high-volume production. And when the company reported results on Thursday, it said the next iteration, that's a 7 nanometer, would be delayed by a year. Intel said what's different is that they're going to be pretty pragmatic about if and when they should be making a step inside or making it outside and making sure they have the optionality to build internally, mix and match inside and outside, or go inside in its entirety. Intel's backup plan means it may tap into TSMC to make its chips, but that won't be easy. TSMC's other customers who compete with Intel would likely oppose the Taiwanese companies prioritizing Intel's designs. And TSMC would probably be reluctant to build lots of new production capacity for Intel when there's a chance the U.S. company may switch back to its own factories later. They can't just go to TSMC because it doesn't now have the capacity. Up until now, Intel have spent billions of dollars a year keeping up with the latest manufacturing technology. Many financial analysts are extrapolating this latest delay that outsourcing to another company may mean that Intel may never catch up again. Considering that many manufacturers and software publishers are pushing out products not by its readiness, but by an artificial marketing schedule, the delay by Intel should be viewed as an action by a responsible management. One-third of cable subscribers are on soon-to-expire promo rates. A recent study by equity research company Cowen's reports that about a third of cable TV subscribers are paying promotional deal prices for their current subscriptions rates that will soon expire, and they're going to be bumped up into higher prices. The survey was conducted on June the 26th to the 27th with over 1,000 U.S. consumers for the Cowen Second Quarter Cable TV and Satellite Video Report. Cowen reports that 20% of those paying promotional rates for cable TV plans are on deals that will expire within the next 21 months. Viewers will be in for a significant price increase once those promo rates run out. Only 10% of the survey respondents reported being grandfathered into a price-for-life plan that guarantees no inflated bills. Although these cable subscribers are about to be paying exorbitant prices for TV, 76% of those surveyed by Cowen in the latest research said they're using a streaming service along with a cable subscription. OTT streaming is increasingly becoming a staple even among diehard cable fans. Of those surveyed, 59% reported using Amazon Prime Video, with 40% subscribing to Hulu, up from 33% last year. The rapid increase is largely due to the onset of the streaming wars and the current pandemic lockdown, and three, the rise in unemployment as consumers test drive low-cost, free solutions to rationalize video wallet share. This just goes to show that even if you're signed up for a cable plan at an introductory rate, you're headed for a hefty price increase once that promotional window expires and will be stuck paying full price for your entertainment content that you could be getting via an add-on to the streaming service you already have a subscription to. And by the way, over the air, which is the standard TV channels you used to get with an antenna, is available free on the internet. The present cable television package bundles have gotten to be too expensive. The average television viewer access about 17 channels on a regular basis, but are paying for access to over 200 channels they don't watch. Or they want our programs on streaming demand and the local television channels they used to watch and receive over the air with the antenna, mostly for local news and weather. Well, there is free local broadcast service, and it's called Locast. It now has 1.4 million users. Along with announcing that its free service has expanded to Miami and West Palm Beach, Locast shared today that it now serves over 1.4 million users with the addition of the new Florida locations. Locast is now available in 21 markets, which cover 134 million viewers, or 41% of the U.S. population. What is Locast? Locast provides local broadcast signals over the internet in select cities, offering similar channels to those you would get with an antenna, including ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, PBS, Get TV, Decades, and Buzzer. The free streaming service is run by a nonprofit organization, Sports Fans Coalition. Locast.org is a digital translator, meaning that Locast.org operates just like a traditional broadcast translator service, except instead of using an over-the-air signal to boost a broadcaster's reach, they stream the signal over the internet to consumers located within select U.S. cities. Is Locast really free? Locast says it runs as a public service, offering local channels for free. The service does ask viewers for donations to help keep up with running the operation. While the donations are voluntary, Locast users say that notification asking for $5 donation come up frequently. Is Locast legal? The organization behind Locast says there is an exception in the FCC rules that allows them to air locals without paying the stations for the service. They say the service is protected by Title 17, Chapter 1, Section 111, the copyright section that allows nonprofits to avoid many of the fees companies would typically pay to broadcast channels. The streaming service has been in a legal battle with ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC since last summer, and at that time, Locast sent Cord Cutters News the following statement. Locast is an independent, nonprofit organization that provides a public service retransmitting free over-the-air broadcasts. Its activities are expressly permitted under the Copyright Act. The fact that no broadcasters have previously filed suit for more than a year and a half suggests that they recognize this. They look forward to defending the claims and the public's right to receive transmission broadcasts over the airwaves. Locast is currently in the following markets: Atlanta, Baltimore, Boston, Chicago, Dallas, Denver, Houston, Los Angeles, Miami, New York, Philadelphia, Phoenix, Puerto Rico, Rapid City, San Francisco, Seattle, Sioux City, Sioux Falls, Tampa Bay, Washington, D.C., West Palm Beach. And you can watch these programs on the following devices: Android, iOS, Android TV, Apple TV, Amazon Fire TV, Roku, TiVo, Dish Hopper, and DirecTV. If you want more information, it's Locast, that's locast.org. One of the oldest businesses on the internet just got sold for $9 billion. The company's startup was in September of 1995. That company was eBay. It is one of the world's oldest business, and now it has a new owner. Norway's Adevinta is buying eBay, classified ads business, for $9.2 billion to create the world's largest online classified company. eBay was one of the first companies to create and market an internet website to match buyers and sellers of goods and services. eBay is a market leader in e-commerce worldwide. In the age of Google and Facebook, classifieds aren't exactly a mammoth business. They make up about 3% of the $125 billion internet advertising market in 2019. According to the Interactive Advertising Bureau, the global industry body for digital advertising. But there was a day when Craigslist and the company that became eBay Classifieds were among the biggest advertising platforms on the World Wide Web. eBay was brought to life as Auction Web. eBay's classifieds business was first known as DBA, a popular Danish all-classifieds newspaper that started publishing in the 1970s. It tried its hand with a fledgling web in 1995, just months after Jerry and David's guide to the World Wide Web became Yahoo. eBay bought DBA and a ton of other classified businesses around the world, and in 2008 to form eBay Classifieds Group. But classifieds were never really core to eBay's e-commerce ambitions. Classifieds delivered revenues of just about $248 million in the first quarter of 2020, or just over 10% of the company's total. With a history of spinning off non-core businesses, and they spun off Skype, PayPal, and StubHub, eBay decided to offload yet another as it struggles to keep pace with much larger rival Amazon. A meaner and leaner eBay, the sale by eBay is part of a strategic review that was announced in March of 2019 under pressure from activist investors. Advente reportedly beat out private equity firm Blackstone and Prosus, part of South African media company Naspers, in the auction of eBay Classifieds Group, which includes Gumtree. Australia's auto trader and motors company, as part of the transaction, eBay will receive $2.5 billion in cash and $540 million of Advente shares, or about 44% of the global online classifieds specialists. That will give eBay continued exposure to the classified ads business while generating cash. This sale creates short-term and long-term value for shareholders and customers while allowing them to participate in the future potential of the classifieds business. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell on his continuing IT Pro Series. Preparing and planning for what happens if I got hit by a bus.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. It's time to talk about something that applies in the work world, but it really should apply in everyone's lives. What I'm presenting comes from 30 years of experience in IT. And yeah, this is something that applies in so many different directions, in so many different realms. It doesn't belong just in IT. It does not belong in just one particular portion of life or anything like this. We need, all of us, to practice a particular philosophy that really is grander. It's bigger than anything that you might imagine. When I sit down, when I go to work, one of the concepts that sticks in my mind, that's emblazoned upon everything that I do, is to constantly refer to what happens if I get hit by a bus. Now, there are so many different variations on this. What happens if I get hit by a bear truck? What happens if I get hit by whatever it is? I don't worry about that. I worry about not the wording of this. What happens if I get hit by a kangaroo? I don't know. I worry more about not what I get hit by, but what happens if I get hit. So we need to be applying this everywhere. It is so easy. I've known so many people that try to guard information. They sit there and they have their arms around their job. If I tell anybody what I do, they're going to try and steal my job. Or if my boss finds out what I do, he is going to, or how little I do, he is going to come along and he's going to fire me. If so-and-so finds out what I do, they're going to encroach in upon my job area. They're going to join my career field, and I don't want that. No, no, all of this does not make any sense. I will tell you, I'm going to be very honest with you. So much of what I do with technology is actually very easy. It's very simple. It's not all that complex. And that is not because the work is not complex. It's not because of anything that has to do with the work. It actually has to do with me. It has to do with, and I understand this. I understand that I have a gift with technology. I have a gift of being able to sit down at a computer and go, oh, this is the problem here. And people are going, how did you know that? Well, part of it's experience. Part of it is also just understanding the philosophy of how we got from A to B. The computer was working. The computer's not working. How did we get from the computer working to not working? Well, it's probably one of these three things, one of these four things, five things, whatever it is. And I unpack all of these different items. I go, all right, is it in this suitcase? Is it in that suitcase? Is it in this briefcase? Is it in this? Oh, there it is. It's right here in this backpack. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. I just feel like it needs to be figured out easily. It's usually not complex. So we go to that other item, the thing that's the really the core of this, and that is, what happens if I get hit by a bus? So when I sit down, I started a new job about a little over a year ago. And when I started with that company, as I was learning things, I wrote them down in a Word document. Now, the neat thing is that Word document is not prepared as notes for myself. That Word document is not prepared as something that is referential only to me. That Word document has been predominantly set up as an instructional document for whoever comes in next, whoever comes along and takes my job, whoever comes along and works alongside of me, whoever comes along and works in the same department, in the same role, but in a different location, or even somebody in a different department doing the exact same thing I do. It doesn't matter. I don't care. It's value to me. But even more of a value is I'm not hiding anything. I am making it easier because, you know what? I would have loved to have had a similar document. Somebody coming along and saying, hey, do X, Y, Z, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all of these different things in this order, and it'll all work out fine. No, I had to discover them all the way along. In random order. So X comes before Z. Okay, all right, all right. There should be something in between here. Is there? Oh, yeah, it's Y. Okay, great. All right. So I note all of these things down. I put everything down because someday I'm not going to be here. Someday I'm going to be gone. And of what value am I? Of what importance am I if I don't leave something behind that says, hey, this is what we did. This is how we did it. And this is the problems we ran into. And this is the problems we can avoid. And this is everything. It's all right here in this simple little booklet. Okay, it's 80 pages long now, but that's just me. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Attackers can alter the firmware of fast charger devices to deliver extra voltage and damage connected equipment. The Internet of Things is creating serious new security risk. Chinese security researchers said they can alter the firmware of fast chargers to cause damage to connected charging systems, such as melt components or even set devices on fire. The technique, named Bad Power, was detailed last week in a report published by Huang Hulab, a research unit of Chinese tech giant Tencent. According to researchers, bad power works by corrupting the firmware of fast chargers, a new type of charger that was developed in the past few years to speed up charging times. A fast charger looks like any typical charger, but works using special firmware. The firmware talks to a connected device and negotiates a charging speed based on the device's capabilities. If a fast charging device is not supported, the fast charger delivers the standard 5 volts. But if the device can handle bigger inputs, the fast charger can deliver up to 12 volts, 20 volts, or even more for faster charging speeds. The bad power technique works by altering the default charging parameter to deliver more voltage than the receiving device can handle, which degrades and damages the receiver's components as they heat up, bend, melt, or even burn. Bad power attack is silent and fast. A bad power attack is silent as there are no prompts or interactions the attacker needs to go through, but also fast, as the threat actor only needs to connect their attack rig to the fast charger, wait a few seconds, and leave having modified the firmware. Furthermore, on some fast charge models, the attacker doesn't need special equipment, and researchers say that the attack code can also be loaded on regular smartphones and laptops. When the user connects the infected smartphone or laptop to the fast charger, the malicious code modifies the charger's firmware, and going forward, the fast charger will execute a power overload for any subsequently connected devices. The damage caused by a bad power attack usually varies depending on the fast charger model and its charging capabilities, but also on charge device and the protections. Researchers tested 35 fast chargers, found 18 vulnerable. The Tencent team said that they verified their bad power attack in practice. Researchers said that they selected the 36 fast chargers from 234 models available on the market and found that 18 models from 8 vendors were vulnerable. The good news is that most bad power problems can be fixed by updating the device firmware. The bad news is that the research team also analyzed 34 fast charging chips around which the fast charger models had been built. Researchers said that 18 chip vendors did not ship chips with a firmware update option, meaning there was no way to update the firmware on some fast charger chips. Tencent researchers said they notified all affected vendors about their findings, but also the Chinese National Vulnerabilities Database, in an attempt to accelerate the development and promotion of relevant security standards to protect against bad power attacks. Suggestions to fix the bad power problem include hardening the firmware to prevent unauthorized modifications, but also deploying overload protection to charge devices. How to fix Windows 10's latest no internet connection bug. Windows 10's updates tend to break things, and the most recent Windows 10 version 2004 update is no exception. The latest bug prevents Windows 10 apps from accessing the internet even when the PC is successfully connected and your web browser is working just fine. The bug seems to show up without warning or reason. If you see a yellow no internet access error triangle in the Windows 10 system tray and can't connect to the internet in the app, but can browse the web as you normally would, you've got the bug. Well, let's put it this way, it's a Microsoft bug. Microsoft acknowledged this bug in a support forum thread and says it stems from an issue with Windows 10 network connectivity status indicator. The company is investigating and will patch the problem once a solution is found, but for some users, a reliable workaround should restore network connection for your app in the meantime. This is how you do it. You do a search using the following text in your browser. Fix the Windows 10 version 2004, that's the numeric number 2004, network connectivity. I'll repeat that again as a sentence and the spaces are in there. Fix the Windows 10 version 2004 network connectivity. There's a text as well as a YouTube clip for the workaround. With luck, your app will be able to connect to the internet again once you reboot your PC. If they don't, double-check your input that the registry fix was properly entered. If you're still out of luck, you'll just have to wait until Microsoft can come up with a patch. How to connect all those devices together? You're starting to add more devices to share the internet. There are just so many connecting LAN ports on the router supplied by the internet carrier. Many are doing this by wireless connections to the internet. But at some point in time, you may need to have more hardwired LAN connections to the router. The simplest solution is to use an internet switch in which the router is connected to the internet switch as well as all the other devices requiring hardwired connections. When making a purchase for Ethernet hardware for LAN connectivity, there are the Ethernet hub, the unmanaged Ethernet switch, and the managed Ethernet switch. What is the difference between an Ethernet hub and switch? A hub will send incoming data packets to all ports, whereas a switch understands the packet's addressing scheme and will send any data packet only to its destination port, thus limiting the number of collisions. Which is better, hub or switch? Obviously, the switch is better than the hub because it is more intelligent. For example, port A needs to send data to port B. The hub will simply flood all available ports while the switch will forward the data to the appropriate port. This results in more efficient throughput use of the hardware. An Ethernet switch today is a relatively inexpensive item. An Ethernet switch with four ports costs about $20. Then we have the unmanaged and managed network switch. Here's what you need to know about the differences between a managed and unmanaged switch when looking to create a local area network. Switches are essentially smart boxes that connect a number of other devices together on a local area network called a LAN, that's L-A-N, and utilize what is called packet switching to forward data to and from said connections. PCs are connected via Ethernet cabling. By the way, the connecting cable is RJ45. The actual size of a switch can range from just a handful of ports all the way up to 48 and more. Switches themselves can be used in the home, a small office, or at a location where multiple machines need to be hooked up. There are two basic kinds of switches, managed and unmanaged, and which is best for you depends on your requirements. A managed Ethernet switch is a device that can be configured and properly managed to offer a more tailored experience to those who will be utilizing the box. These not only offer tools and the means to monitor a network, but also control over traffic where you'll be in charge of setting up everything, managing device, and take responsibility for any configurations that can cause downtime. When looking at managed switches, there are two types available. Smart switches have a limited number of options for configuration, are more affordable than their fully managed siblings, ideal for home and office use. Fully managed solutions are targeted at servers and enterprises, offering a wide variety of tools and features to manage the immediate network better. Managed switches are designed for intense workloads, high amounts of traffic, and deployments where custom configurations are a necessity. Then we have the unmanaged Ethernet switches. When a managed switch requires, well, some management in exchange for your network working exactly how you want, an unmanaged switch works with no input from you. These network devices will work in the most basic form, allowing for your devices to connect with one another. The configuration is locked to OEM specification and provides consumers peace of mind to connect everything up and get going. Think of unmanaged switches as adding additional Ethernet ports to your network. Should you have a limited number of available outlets on routers and access points, unmanaged switches are perfect for allowing for additional hardware to be connected. Unmanaged switches are best suited for home and small office use. Unmanaged switches are pretty basic compared to managed counterparts. The affordable price tag doesn't make this a bad switch. However, a managed switch allows you to have more control over the network as well as all traffic that moves through the devices. An unmanaged switch takes this control away and handles everything automatically. The former is for advanced users, and the latter is specifically built for beginners and those who wish to simply build a network and leave it to technology to oversee the traffic. Both managed and unmanaged Ethernet switch, which is best for you? Should you be comfortable with managing a LAN and configuring everything? Then a managed switch is a powerful option. Those who wish to keep things simple at home should go with an unmanaged solution. For the home and small business installation, keep it simple to maintain, and the unmanaged switch will enable you to let technology oversee the traffic. For the home and small business consumer, the unmanaged switch enables you to keep the local area network simple to maintain and just let the technology run the traffic automatically. If you have the time and the technical background, then the managed switch enables you to tweak the network to maximize throughput traffic. However, for the average consumer, this is above the pay grade level. Bloatware. What it is and how to get rid of it. One of my favorite subjects. Is your new Windows system laden with unnecessary or even harmful software? It's called bloatware because it was installed by the manufacturer of the system. You would think that they would sell you a pristine system. When you buy a new Windows PC, you expect it to be clean and lean, starting up fast and speeding through your work as quickly as you need it to. If that was the only case. Truth is, most Windows PCs start off slower than they should, clogged with unnecessary preloaded software. This unnecessary add-on is known as bloatware, or a number of other less complimentary terms. This software comes in many different forms. Most bloatware isn't dangerous, but it can slow down your system and take up resources such as storage space and memory when it's loaded. How much does bloatware slow down your PC? It's hard to say, but there are some indications that it can have a considerable effect. According to Microsoft, based on computers that are free of third-party software, system startup on average is 104% faster. That means twice as fast. Shutdown, 35% faster, and have 28 minutes more of battery life than the same laptops with bloatware. Why do PC vendors put additional software on new machines in the first place? Sometimes it's simply in order to offer tools that would add functionality to their systems. But most of the time, that's not the case. It's because including third-party applications are an additional source of income or revenue. The fundamental problem is that Windows PC are a very low-margin business, especially on the low end, and vendors will do whatever they can to increase revenue. Software makers pay them to put bloatware on PCs. No one will tell you how much money is involved, but it is estimated it might be as high as $20 a machine. If you sell a $300 computer, that $20 per machine is a lot of additional revenue. Manufacturers frequently include their own software on PCs they sell. For example, Lenovo often includes its Lenovo Solution Center, a maintenance application that does things such as checking your hardware for problems and making sure you update software. Trialware is software that you can get to use for free for a certain amount of time, but that you have to pay for it when you want to use it after that, for say 30 days or 6 months. Among the most common kind of trialware is security software made by companies such as McAfee and Norton. And they are put on because in Europe, it's a requirement, it's a law, and they must put it on. Or antivirus programs slow down a PC to some degree. I would check its full scan schedule. I would also check to see if Windows indexing system is on. What to do about bloatware on your PC? In some cases, you can remove it simply by uninstalling it. And a good strategy when you get a new system is to check it for software before you install any applications of your own and uninstall any programs you know you won't want. If you're not sure whether you want it or not, even after doing a bit of research, then simply note its existence so that you can get back to removing it at a later date. Presenting Marty Winston on his All Hands on Tech, when the thermostat is where it's at. Everyone knows what a thermostat does. Many people know what a smart thermostat does. Marty Winston will look at what it does and wonder what else it ought to be doing.
Hey, give credit where it's due. The thermostat represented pioneering automation when a Dutchman named Drebbel invented it 400 years ago. Happy birthday, thermostat, in 1620, to regulate the temperature of a chicken incubator. That one used mercury. 210 years later, a Scotsman invented a bimetallic thermostat, two different metals bonded back to back so they'd curl and uncurl when temperature changed. That time, it was for textile mills. In 1883, a Johnson from Wisconsin patented a bimetal room thermostat. If you've ever heard of Johnson Controls, he's the Johnson at its origin. And in 1886, Albert Butts got the patent for an electric thermostat, and his company grew into what became Honeywell. The thermostat was the first home automation device. Well, the first electronic one anyway. Maybe the spring that pulled the screen door shut was the very first. Not sure it matters. What may matter is what thermostats can be doing today and what they could be doing in just a couple of years. Speaking of Johnson Controls, they acquired Lux, L-U-X products, makers of smart residential thermostats, and Lux promised to send their new CS1 model for review. It costs less than most smart thermostats, but does tricks, like using geofencing to know if you're home or away. And speaking of Honeywell, if you get a chance, look up the Honeywell Prestige IAQ Thermostat Kit. Resideo, the company behind the Honeywell brand for thermostats and several other categories, Resideo sent a Prestige here for review. You might be interested in some of what it can do and think about how that compares to what your thermostat can do. You'd expect any thermostat to turn on the furnace or whatever you use to warm up the house whenever the house gets too cold, and the same for air conditioning when it gets too hot. You might want to have the choice of only running the HVAC blower fan when the heating or air conditioning is running, or keeping that fan on 24/7, which is, surprisingly, well worth considering. So that's three things: heating, cooling, and the fan. How about dehumidifying? Do you have a whole house dehumidifier? There's a Honeywell DR90 here, able to connect to the HVAC return and pull 90 pints of water per day, which is 90 pounds, out of the air. It also has a forced air intake for when you want to blend some fresh air into the mix. Then there's that dry weather need to add humidity, and an April Air 600M just arrived to do that job again, doing a bypass flow-through connection to the ductwork. And that Prestige treats humidity a lot like temperature. You tell it your targets, and it automatically turns on whichever thing it needs to turn on to get the humidity where you want it. It has a separate control for the fresh air intake. You might want to set that for so many minutes per hour, for example, at selected times of day. The thermostat it replaced wouldn't do that. That old thing wouldn't even switch itself between heating and cooling. The occupant had to do that. But this one, wait until you hear the bedtime story. Let's say you tell your Honeywell Prestige thermostat that your bedtime is 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., and that it has a wireless indoor air sensor in your bedroom. What do you think it's going to do? Your first guess is probably right, that it's going to let that bedroom sensor become its source of temperature and humidity information, governing its control over everything. But it's even smarter than that. It learns. Every time it shifts from one thing to another, it's monitoring how long it takes to get there. So if that bedroom is always 5 degrees off in temperature and 5% off in humidity compared to what the main thermostat reads, and if the system finds that it always takes 11 minutes or 13 minutes or whatever to make the bedroom reach the right temperature and humidity, The thermostat system learns that. It automatically adapts. It will automatically know to start its transition 11 or 13 or whatever minutes early. It will automatically get that room to where you wanted it by the time when you wanted it there. Most of the vendors of smart thermostats have had at least one model through here for review, and they're okay, but not as big league as this Honeywell Prestige, which isn't to say that the Prestige is perfect. If you want scheduling and smartphone apps and remote fiddling with your settings and that kind of thing, they're all pretty good. It's when you want to involve more information coming in, more sensors, more kinds of data, and more kinds of control going out, more devices, more IAQ indoor air quality factors. Those are the things that make for more than a smart thermostat, and maybe more than a smarter thermostat. But hold on, if that's true, is something missing? More than a half a dozen of the companies behind smart thermostats had me challenge them over the past few weeks. What if a thermostat can gain even more information? Does it have some way to benefit people in their homes? AirThings makes a very nice radon monitor. Radon gas comes up through the ground and almost every home has some, not necessarily a dangerous level. Also, radon levels can vary. For example, radon levels tend to go up when it rains. When it reaches worrisome levels, over 4, radon mitigation professionals can seal off some of the sources and install an always-on forced air exhaust. As long as you maintain your house at a positive pressure, meaning the air pressure inside is greater than the air pressure outside, limited exhausts can be very productive, but you may want to compensate for them by adding some forced fresh air intake. Exhausts reduce pressure, intakes raise pressure, and raised pressure is good. In a house with radon mitigation installed, or just to be careful in any house, a thermostat might enforce extra forced air intake time when it rains, or when the indoor air pressure isn't greater than the outdoor air pressure, or somebody might figure out some way for the thermostat to integrate those readings from an AirThings radon detector. By the way, in addition to radon, it also reads total volatile organic compounds, also called TVOCs, CO2, carbon dioxide, temperature, humidity, and air pressure. There are other indoor air quality factors, and when it comes to consumer-facing products, there's still nothing that measures more than UHO, that's UHOO, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, nitrogen dioxide, ozone, volatile organic compounds, also called VOCs, small particulates called PM2.5, air pressure, temperature, humidity, all in UHO. Couldn't a thermostat make some good use of all that extra data? Shouldn't it? Of course, part of the question is, what would that let it do? How can that extra information be useful? And that just covers the indoors. Outdoors, in the yard, a new Weatherflow Tempest is reporting temperature, humidity, dew point, air pressure, rainfall, winds, brightness, UV exposure, lightning strikes, and air density. Weatherflow tells us they can make more or other data available if one of the thermostat designers will tell them what that should be. Think about it. Would it help to have a warning that the temperature will be dropping 11 degrees in the presence of a storm and strong winds, all arriving in about 45 minutes? Is that something a thermostat might want to know? Something that could benefit the comfort of occupants? Over at the thermostat companies, everybody gets a little defensive when you ask, and ask, and ask. Emerson, you probably know them best as the brand behind the Sensi smart thermostats, but it's also interesting to note that their various divisions make most of the sub-assemblies that go into the brand name HVAC systems. Anyway, Emerson has two interesting things going on. One is called Sensi Predict, and you don't have to be using a Sensi thermostat to have your pro install this. Sensors are its strength. It places 10 sensors into the HVAC system. There are air temperature sensors in the supply and return trunks, plus refrigerant line temperature sensors at the liquid line going from the outside unit's condenser coil to the house and on the suction line coming into the outside unit's compressor from the house. Also, power draw monitors at both the indoor unit and the outdoor unit, and two control line sensors, one indoors to monitor calls from the thermostat and the other outdoors to monitor calls sent to the compressor. That's enough sensor data to tell you and your service pro when there's a frozen coil, when a furnace won't start, when it takes too long to come to temperature, when significant parts fail, and more. It's not you and a flashlight and guesswork, and often it can catch problems before they turn into failures. Emerson thermostats also can work with local utility demand response programs to get a little more of the HVAC work to happen during the off-peak energy hours, and less of it to happen when the peaks hit and grids can get overwhelmed. That can save grief and money. Finally, April Air engineer wizard John Blomer had a lot to share. For example, he said that with a MERV 13 filter, running your HVAC's fan 20 minutes each hour makes your indoor air 95% cleaner than your outdoor air. And a thermostat can set that up to happen. When pressed for a better way for future products to make beneficial use of information from sensors and connected devices, he had some sweet ideas about ways to use weather data. He said, if there's a way to know what's coming, that might let ventilation run in an economizer mode, bringing in cool outside air to supplement indoor cooling during air conditioning season, as one example. Or, if tomorrow's going to be hot, the thermostat could adjust to cool the house down even more than usual tonight, when energy is available and there's less of a demand on the power lines. That helps reduce the load the system would need to demand tomorrow. But he warns about wanting to push for too much too soon, given that the capabilities of today's best thermostats are already impressive. He says, and I quote, "Smarter systems are coming, but we as an industry have to balance technology, cost, and homeowner use. So even though we engineers can make a thing happen, we need the market and the technology to catch up before that can become commonplace." End quote. Coming from a thermostat design engineer, we take that to mean cool it. Okay. Next time, you'll hear about a growing trend in tools. Tools that can get their work done without ever coming into contact with the thing that you're working on. Know what? I'll bet that the tools in lots of today's tool chests have more lasers in them than the bad guys had in those old flying saucer movies. Be here for no-touch tools at work, which is better than touchy tools that don't work. That work for you?
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Some of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For update information, visit the website of the computer club. And if you're interested in the subject itself, RSVP so you can get a meeting ID. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting Thursday, August the 13th at 7 p.m. The topic of presentation is how to set up RetroPie on the Raspberry Pi. RSVP at nyacc.org if you're interested for a Zoom meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 11th, and their meeting time is 8 p.m. via Amazon Chime. For more information on how to get onto Amazon, RSVP to acgnj.org. For more information on how you can participate via Amazon Chime. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on PRN.FM on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send me an email addressed to Hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do your regular backups on your computer. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for your support. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.